The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say to safety, he's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Cantor Bruce Rubin, the head of the School of Sacred Music at Hebrew Union College in New York. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. There was a very entertaining and quite ridiculous follow-up to the serious story on the killing of Osama bin Laden last week. Amidst all the reporting on the backstory of the government and military work that went into ending the career of the world's best-known terrorist, a photo came out of the administration officials in Washington, D.C., sitting in a room watching the raid on the bin Laden compound in Pakistan. That picture showed the president and a group of 11 other top advisors watching the attack. But when the photo ran in the Brooklyn-based Hasidic newspaper Der Zeitung, a Yiddish language almost daily, it isn't published on Shabbos, lo and behold, two people were missing from the picture. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and National Security Team member Audrey Thomason. They had been photoshopped out of the photo because the paper, an ultra-Orthodox periodical, has a policy of never showing pictures of women lest they be considered inappropriate for reasons of modesty. Let us note that both women in the original photo were dressed in clothing that would have looked just fine on the streets of Mea Shearim or Williamsburg or Borough Park. Their arms are covered, their hair is modest, no skin besides their faces or hands show. And for this, they were nonetheless thoughtfully removed from the photo by the Hasidim. Well, the outrage at this act of photoshoppery, some people called it faux shopping, as well as the comedic response, was pretty total. A lot of it focused on the obvious sexism of this pictorial exorcism, but some focused on the anti-historical nature of revising a photo to exclude key players from history. Most people found it outrageous, others highly humorous. The paper published an explanation which read in part, "Our editorial policies are guided by a rabbinical board and because of laws of modesty does not allow for the publishing of photos of women. The readership of the Zeitung believes that women should be appreciated for who they are and what they do, not for what they look like. And the Jewish laws of modesty are an expression of respect for women, not the opposite. The allegations by some that Orthodox Judaism denigrates women or does not respect women in public office is a malicious slander and libel. The Jewish religion does not allow for discrimination based on gender or race. The current Secretary of State, the Honorable Hillary R. Clinton, was for 8 years a senator representing New York State with great distinction. She won overwhelming majorities in the Orthodox Jewish communities in her initial campaign in 2000, and when she was reelected in 2006, it was because the religious community, among others, appreciated her unique capabilities, talents, and compassion for all. We respect all government officials. We even have special prayers for the welfare of our government and the government leaders. In retrospect, we apologize for any misunderstanding this might have caused. We should not have published the altered picture, and we convey our regrets and apologies to the White House and to the State Department." Well, next thing you know, I suppose they will be publishing photos of the Situation Room showing a photoshopped in Hasidic rabbi sitting in Hillary's seat advising the president on military policy. Once you start to fake things, well, Frankly, this was a ridiculous act, this photoshopping out of two women, including our Secretary of State, who were integral to the operation. As the paper said, if in its own ridiculous logic it chooses never to show photos of women, it shouldn't have altered the photo to pretend they weren't there in the first place. It is, after all, a publication that's supposed to be journalistic. Now, if anyone alive finds those two women's photos in the original to be in any way salacious, let me tell you, that person has more problems to deal with than halachic ones. But in any case, this Der Zeitung Photoshop controversy also raises for me a question of journalistic integrity in the Jewish press in general, one that has important implications for those of us who straddle the world between journalism and Judaism. To be honest, it's a fact that a lot more than the photos of female members of the administration are being regularly airbrushed out of the Jewish press. I happen to live in Tucson, Arizona, a Jewish community of about 30,000 Jews, where the local paper is run by the Jewish Federation, and all the other Jewish periodicals or websites or email listservs are published by Jewish community organizations and synagogues. I've been here for about 12 years now. I can tell you that during that time, one of the largest Jewish nonprofit organizations in town went into and out of a large bankruptcy without that fact ever intruding its ugly head into the local paper or website or any other local Jewish publication. I can also tell you that our local federation itself downsized dramatically when its campaign funds shrunk 2 years ago, and that the scope and nature of its changes were never accurately reported. I can also tell you that within the past year, a supposedly major synagogue chose to spend all of its dedicated building funds on operations, a big no-no, and narrowly averted being foreclosed on when it couldn't make a balloon payment on a loan. That another synagogue terminated one of its clergy after 18 years of service without cause in what was in part billed as a desperate cost-saving measure. And that another major Jewish nonprofit just missed closing up shop because of severe financial shortfalls and structural changes in its core work. And I can tell you of meetings of 500 people, that's a lot here in southern Arizona, being called in the last few months by leaders of a Jewish organization as it tried to resolve huge political issues it faced. None of this, not a word of it, was reported on by our local Jewish media, not the Federation's newspaper, the Jewish Post, not the Federation's website, JewishTucson.org, nor was it covered by any other Jewish periodical or website or blog, including our synagogue papers. If there were any stories at all on this subject, they were reported either inaccurately or very, very incompletely. Mostly, they weren't covered. In preference, puff pieces were run on the latest Federation boutique social action program or its next trip to Israel or Argentina by the wealthiest members in the community. So look, metaphorically, we have been photoshopping a lot of information out of the news that we report on a regular basis and been doing so for a long time. And those omissions probably matter a lot more than taking Hillary Clinton out of one picture, as ridiculous a thing to do as it was. In our case, as in most Jewish communities, the press limitations are somewhere between self-imposed and imposed from above. I guess in one sense, I play a part in this. Here on the Two Jewish Radio Show, we actually tend to focus on national and international stories and not on local ones like these. We cover the whole Jewish world, and our guests and stories are prominent nationally and internationally. And we cover stories that we think will interest people not just in Arizona or Tucson, where two Jewish is heard live on the radio throughout the state, but everywhere in the country and world, where we have listeners listening through our website, twojewishradio.com, or through our iTunes podcast. But the truth is, a lot of Jewish stories on the local level everywhere in America, especially unflattering ones, are censored out of circulation by our Jewish community leaders, donors, and machers. There's a concept here, a legitimate one, called Shanda Fardegoyim, that something should not be aired if it creates shame for us before non-Jews, that we should hide our dirty linen in a deep, dark closet, sweep it under a rug. Well, sometimes, as in the case of a Bernie Madoff, the story is too big and we can't bury it. But sometimes, such as when our Tzoras is local, we can. And the fact is that usually we are not so much protecting ourselves from being embarrassed in front of non-Jews as we are of sheltering our own people from the truth about our failures as leaders. There is something to be said for discretion. Probably we will continue to exercise it if we believe it protects Jewish community. But in truth, we have very little right to be high and mighty in our approach to a ridiculous paper like Der Zeitung for pretending important women don't exist. After all, we spend a lot of effort pretending no bad things are happening in our own communities and censoring our own media lest we Jews think badly of ourselves. And maybe then we might give less money, God forbid, to Jewish institutions. Well, on a happier note, our guest today, Cantor Bruce Rubin, heads the School of Sacred Music at Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion in New York. Here he is in his cantorial role singing Shalom Rav, the evening prayer for peace by David Edelman.
Shalom Rav, Shalom Rav, Shalom Rav, Al Yisrael, Amachat Hasim, Amachat Hasim, Amachat.
Was our guest this morning, Cantor Bruce Rubin, in a play-in singing Shalom Rav. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll meet him, the head of the Hebrew Union College School of Sacred Music, Jewish Institute of Religion, the major reform movement training ground for cantors, our musical professionals, when we come back on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, most of the time I'm talking about the great pizza we serve at Mama's, but not today. Nope. Today I want to tell you about our calzones. A calzone is kind of like a stuffed pizza. It's made of dough wrapped around whatever ingredients you want, like pepperoni, mushrooms, or even artichoke hearts. There's lots of cheese inside, and it's served with a cup of marinara sauce. Our calzones are huge. We had a guy order two of them over the phone, and when he picked them up, he couldn't believe it. There were only two people eating, and two large calzones feed 6 to 8 people easy. You know, it wouldn't hurt you to try a calzone next time you're in. Then, if they get real popular, we might have to change our name to Mama's Calzones. Mama's Pizza, 4500 East Speedway in the Midway Business Park, on east side of 22nd and Colb and back at the Fry Shopping Center, on the north side at the southwest corner of Oracle and McGee, and on newest at Broadway and Houghton. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Tucson Hebrew Academy is an independent school for children from kindergarten through eighth grade. Has a long-standing track record of academic excellence and an unparalleled integrated general and Jewish studies curriculum. With a variety of music and fine arts classes combined with the award-winning sports programs, THA nourishes students in body, mind, and spirit. The atmosphere in the classroom encourages self-assured self-expression, critical thinking, and respect for diverse points of view. THA's low student-teacher ratio gives its highly qualified faculty the ability to provide instruction based on the most up-to-date proven research methods in science, technology, math, and literature. THA students understand the relevance of Jewish values in a modern world. THA sees learning as a way of life and builds a strong sense of community. THA Tucson Hebrew Academy is enrolling now. Give your child the gift of a THA education. For more information on how to enroll or to schedule a tour, call 529-3888. That's 529-3888 or visit thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning, Cantor Bruce Rubin. He's the director of the School of Sacred Music at Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion in New York. He has taught Jewish history at HUCJIR and the history of Jewish music at the Juilliard School. And for the past, I don't know, is it 15 years? He has served as an adjunct professor of history at Hunter College, where he's taught classes on world history, modern Jewish history, and the Holocaust. He served as cantor of Temple Shari Tefillah in New York City for many years, where he's organized all kinds of musical programs, and he has been on the commissioning board of cantors of the School of Sacred Music all along. We welcome the two Jewish, Cantor Bruce Rubin. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
So tell us briefly a little bit about the School of Sacred Music, how it became its own institution in a way within Hebrew Union College.
Well, after World War II, a lot of the European source for cantors in America obviously was gone. And the pressure to create a school to teach the cantorial art grew tremendously. And a group of cantors, musicians, composers in the Jewish world got together, multi-denominational, from Orthodox through Reform, to try to make it happen. And through the hard work of particularly Eric Werner, a famous Jewish musicologist, he interceded with the board at Hebrew Union College, and Hebrew Union College agreed to step forward and start the school, which in the beginning was meant to train cantors for Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox congregations. And that started in 1948.
You know, it's funny. So many of the institutions of the Reform movement were started to create American institutions, not necessarily specifically Reform ones. But of course, things in America tend to get denominational along the way. School of Sacred Music used to focus, I would say, on a lot of the German Jewish repertoire, sort of the classical sense of a cantorial singer. It's a different world today, isn't it?
Oh, it sure is. There's been a real evolution. But it always had a number of different foci. One was clearly to learn that the 19th century repertoire you were talking about, like
Lewandowski, Zulzer, and Naumburg.
But also the great composers of the 1950s, 60s, 70s in America.
Sure.
People like Abraham Binder, Max Helfman.
Max Janowski.
Oh, you know all the names, yes. wonderful, wonderful composers who themselves were very steeped in Jewish tradition. So that was another piece of it, but they always had a tremendous commitment to the ancient Jewish chant tradition called Nusach,
right,
which really invests the liturgy with a musical vocabulary for the whole liturgical year. And that's always been a very important emphasis. So having said that, you're right, the repertoire has changed out in the Reform movement around the country, so we're not the type to give up older things, though, so we tend to just add on the contemporary repertoire with guitar and folk style to that list of things I've already put before you. So it's a very challenging program.
I would think so. We'll talk more about which directions Jewish music is going when we return on Too Jewish with cantor Bruce Rubin in just a few moments.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
The Jewish outdoor holiday of Lag BaOmer is a wonderful, fun way to celebrate the early summer. Lag BaOmer combines a picnic, bonfire, lots of Israeli songs, and great activities for kids, teens, and adults on a beautiful in-town ranch. Saturday night, May 21st, starting at 5 p.m., join Temple Emmanuel for fabulous Lag BaOmer fun, including hayrides, ball games, horses, stargazing, contests, songs, and stories to celebrate the holiday. Everyone's welcome to the Temple Emmanuel Lag BaOmer picnic and bonfire on Saturday, May 21st at 5 p.m. Call 327-4501 for more information on Lag BaOmer with the Temple. It's just $7 for adults for dinner, dessert, and all the fun. And kids come and eat and play for just $3. Call Temple Emmanuel at 520-327-4501 to join us for Lag BaOmer fun.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there. The Apple iTunes Store is very popular podcasts. And now, a special visit direct from London. We welcome back a good friend of Too Jewish, Rabbi David Wilfond, the legendary Gingy, who is working in England for a year, which we'll talk about how that worked next week. But right now, since you're in London and you were on the scene when the royal wedding took place, well, maybe not actually in, you know, Westminster Abbey, tell us a little bit about the Jewish response to the royal wedding from the English perspective.
First of all, British Jews are wildly supportive of the royal family. We say a prayer for the Queen and the royal family every week. And a couple of times I've questioned in the synagogue, shouldn't we really be saying a prayer for the democratically elected leaders of the nation shouldn't we say a prayer for them? And people say, no, it's the Queen who really needs our prayers, and they would not have us getting rid of the prayer for the Queen. Anyway, the royal...
And by the way, you're serving a liberal Jewish synagogue, which is the equivalent of Reform, and yet still they're saying the prayer for the Queen.
Oh, yeah, and they... Part of it is because they want to be really English. So their way of being what they call Anglo-Jews, or being very English, is in the sermon, you got to mention cricket, and you've got to offer a prayer on behalf of the royal family. And then they feel really comfortable and happy. So that's English Jewry. But when the wedding started happening, people got really, really excited. And the Jewish Chronicle, the local Jewish newspaper, ran a story which we all thought was true because it made so much sense. It said the royal couple, in an acknowledgement of the multicultural society that England has become with over 2 million Muslims and people from all over the world, from Africa, etc., they said they're going to be incorporating rituals of other religions in the ceremony in order to reflect the reality of current-day England. So we were told that the couple would be breaking a glass after the ceremony, and that they'd have a Muslim ritual that they were going to do and a Hindu ritual, and we all watched the ceremony glued. Sure enough, we were disappointed. They never broke the glass.
Oy vey. It's such a tragedy.
Literally, oy vey. But the chief rabbi was present at the ceremony, and he wrote a prayer that he asked all of the synagogues of England to say on the Shabbos of the wedding in order to wish a mazel tov to the queen and her family on the big simcha of her grandchildren, the kinskinder, as we like to say, the grandchildren finally getting married. So people were very happy, very supportive, and we celebrated it on the Shabbat. It happened Friday morning, and that Friday night we had a big party at our own synagogue. That's what people wanted to do.
That's amazing. You know, I remember when I was serving a congregation in Sydney, Australia, which, you know, Australians are not the most respectful people of tradition. And there we were at a bar mitzvah reception. All of a sudden, the senior rabbi got up and he said, "I give you the queen," and lifted his glass. And I looked around thinking like the queen had walked in or something. And I realized what that meant is they were all going to toast the queen.
Oh, you know what I would have thought it was? I thought they're toasting the Shabbos queen.
No, not this time.
No, would have been good if the rabbi lifted his glass.
That would have been good, yeah.
The Shabbos queen.
No, they were busy being Australians. Just
yes,
like
Queen Elizabeth.
Your folks are being, right, Queen Elizabeth, your folks are being English. Thanks, Gingy. We'll be delighted to talk to you next week.
All right, be well.
Be well, take care. Bye-bye. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Israel Center. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi, and happy Yom Ha'atzmaut.
Happy Yom Ha'atzmaut. Now, the real date in Israel was last Monday, but we're celebrating it at the JCC this Sunday with a big festival from 1 o'clock today till 6 p.m. Tell me a little bit about what it's like to celebrate Yom Ha'atzmaut Ba'aretz in Israel.
Well, in Israel, the celebration starts at the evening, like all Jewish holidays, and usually, it's tradition that they start with a ceremony that is run by elementary schools, usually, in most places. After those performances are ending around 9 o'clock p.m., then the real celebration begin with dancings in the street, with musicians that perform in all the corners of the street. Usually, all the cities are filled with stages, with free and open for all performances of singers, dance groups. Around 10 o'clock p.m. in most of Israel, you'll find amazing fireworks in any big city, any small city, any town, usually around 10 o'clock, and the sky just filled with fireworks, which is amazing. It is tradition to celebrate nearly all night long. Even young teenagers go out, they celebrate at the streets, usually after dancing, eating outside and stuff like that, around 1 o'clock a.m., they would gather around all the friends at some, you know, place outside and have a bonfire, sit down maybe with a guitar, sing some songs, tell stories, have fun together, and they get back home around 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning, sleep well, and around 11, their parents will wake them up to come to the traditional family picnic with all their parents' friends. So that's how usually Israelis would celebrate Yom Ha'atzmaut in Israel.
Is there any way for Americans to recreate that sense? I mean, the whole country celebrates. How do we get a feel of that here in America?
Well, first of all, you can come and celebrate with us today at the JCC. We have an amazing program from 1 o'clock all the way to 6 with art fair, with kids' activities, with an amazing performance starting at 5 o'clock of the Revital Dance Group from Israel.
Kind of tracing the whole history of Israel in dance. Food, too, I assume, and drink?
Well, you can't have a Jewish celebration without food, can you?
No. Absolutely. So it's a great day to celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut today, Israel's 63rd birthday. Please go to the JCC from 1 to 6. Guy, thanks, and we say Yom HaAtzmaut Sameach.
Yom HaAtzmaut Sameach.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant, the J Bar in Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, who was just again named a semifinalist for the National James Beard Award for Chef of the Year.
That's right. Good morning, Rabbi. Thank you so much.
Good morning and mazel tov. What's cooking at Janos now?
Well, all sorts of fun things. It's springtime, so this is when my restaurants come into their own, when we get all the new flavors from the gardeners, from baby beets to little peas to citrus. Wonderful things for us to cook with. The menus are light, they're fun. We're doing our 10 terrific taste menu year-round now at Janos, which is actually a misnomer. It's 12 different things over 4 courses. Lots of little mouthfuls of great tastes.
You know, my wife Wendy calls your food magic food.
That's so nice of her to say that. If I cook magic food, the place I do it is at Janos. That's where we pull out all the stops, and that's where it's really, that's the height of the cooking that I do.
What's the phone number for Janos?
615-6100.
Or www.janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, who spent some time in Islamabad, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week, we started talking about some of the local color angles on the killing of Osama bin Laden and Pakistan and Abbottabad, the town in which he was very, as you said, about 99% likely killed. Have you been in the government and not necessarily believing everything the government says? Let's talk a little bit more about assuming that Osama bin Laden is actually, in fact, dead. What does this mean in the eternal Jewish question for the Jews? What does it mean for Israel in general?
Let me just be clear. I'm not only skeptical of what the government says. I'm skeptical of what anybody says. I'm from Missouri. Our nickname is the Show Me State. So I take everything pretty much with a grain of salt until, you know, proven beyond the shadow of a doubt. And it's very hard to do that. I think it is in good taste not to release photos, videos, et cetera, et cetera. You know, who knows what, this is an unprecedented situation in the same way that 9/11 was an unprecedented situation. And I don't think we've ever had a manhunt as intense or as long or with as big a price on somebody's head as this one was. So, you know, I hope it's well and truly over. One of the questions that arises is, how could the Pakistanis not have known? And there I think we have to let them off the hook a little bit, because it's hard in our country to imagine, first of all, how incredibly crowded Pakistan is. It's got roughly 150 million people, most of whom are crowded into small urban areas and not fanned out over the deserts and through the jungles and whatever. I mean, they're heavy concentrations of people, among which it's very easy to be anonymous.
You're like 6'9",
yeah,
or
Osama was a very tall man or whatever, but he never went out. He didn't go out for a daily constitutional outside of his compound. And you know, there probably wasn't an exceptional amount of coming and going, considering that Pakistan is a place, like much of the world, where people have the habit of buying groceries every day and not keeping lots of stuff in the refrigerator because stuff is perishable. It's often sold just before it begins to rot. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons that people have for going out and coming in a lot, and particularly the servants and the working class people have a way in Pakistan of being invisible. Nobody really notices them. So you know, I think to some extent we should not be too quick to leap to the conclusion that, oh, the Pakistanis must have known. But that does speak to some of our national security questions before we come to what does this all mean for Israel. And one of the national security questions is, what about our future relations with Pakistan? Another is, what about our future moves in the war against terrorism? And I think one of the important things that we've discussed before about the war against terrorism is it's not a war against the state. It's not the kind of war we're used to fighting against the state entity, or even the kind of war that we fought against a movement like the Viet Cong, which was closely associated with a state entity and with a government backer. It's a war that transcends borders and transcends clearly defined groups with which have membership lists and mailing lists. So it's a war that's going to go on. It's certainly not going to disappear because of the death of this one man. It wouldn't even disappear if we succeeded in eliminating all of Al-Qaeda, which we have not done and are unlikely to do. So I don't mean to sound like, you know, gloom and doom here, but in one sense, at
least...
That
might also be a Missouri characteristic.
I don't think so. But in one sense, at least, this has almost no impact on our national security interests. The war against terrorism will go on. Some people will be angrier at us now. Some people will be more afraid of us. And some people will be very grateful to us for this recent move. So, you know, net result, in some ways, zero. Certainly not for families of victims of 9/11. Certainly not for all the people involved in this daring raid, all the people who collected painstakingly the intelligence that led to this victorious moment. Yes, we need to continue next week. Thank you.
So we will. Thanks, Tom. And then we'll find out what it means to the Jews.
Okay.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. It was mealtime on an El Al flight to Israel. "Would you like dinner?" the flight attendant asked Moshe. "What are my choices?" Moshe asked. "Yes or no," she replied. Yes, it's that great Israeli tradition of service. Well, it's gotten better. Anyway, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well. And now, a word of Torah. This week in Temple, we complete the reading of the book of Leviticus, a portion of the Torah known as Bechukotai. At the completion of a book focused on holiness and its rituals of sanctification and celebration, we conclude our exploration with a statement of covenant. God says, "If you keep these, my laws of holiness, you will long flourish in the land I will give you." It's a promise based on action. If we live lives dedicated to holiness, our actions will bring blessing. We have the capacity to create a world that is meaning and goodness. But holiness is a strange idea. In Judaism, it's usually something that we create rather than something given to us from above or from the outside. A little example to demonstrate how it is that we can create holiness. A sheepskin is not a holy object, right? Where I'm from originally in Southern California, you use a sheepskin to cover a car seat, especially if you have a convertible. Nothing very holy in that. So what happens if you take that sheepskin and remove the hair and cure it into parchment? Is it holy now? No, it's just a piece of fancy paper. But if you take that parchment and give it to a sofer, a scribe, who writes on it a section of the text of a Torah, and if that piece of parchment is now sewn together with other texts like that, and if that whole parchment roll is wrapped around wooden Atzei Chaim poles, and if it's then dedicated and carried around a synagogue and chanted from publicly and blessings are said over it, and it's used for bar and bat mitzvahs and touched and kissed with the fringes of a talis, well, now that piece of parchment has become something more. It has become holy. But it became holy through our actions. We have taken a common object, a sheepskin, and created out of it an object that is sacred. The abiding lesson of Leviticus is that we have the capacity to make our own lives holy and sacred in a similar way. We can lead lives that are ordinary and prosaic, or we can choose to live truly holy lives. That choice is an ethical one. We make it every day, sometimes every hour, when we decide how we will act. If we give freely of ourselves, Leviticus asks, we increase holiness in the world, and we can give our lives beauty, meaning, and sanctity. When we come back, we'll talk with cantor Bruce Rubin about holiness, but mostly about Jewish music and just what it is a cantor does. He heads the School of Sacred Music, all in a few moments on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
As usual, last week the Syrian military proved it is most effective making war against its own people rather than fighting actual armies. The army, that is the Syrian army, shelled residential areas in central Syria, a sharp escalation in the government's attempts to crush a popular revolt against President Bashar Assad's rule. Heavy gunfire was heard as at least three residential neighborhoods were hit by tank fire in the besieged city of Homs, Syria, which has experienced some of the largest anti-government demonstrations in recent weeks. There were loud explosions and gunfire from automatic rifles throughout the night and into the morning, a resident said. The area is totally besieged. We are being shelled. Activists in Damascus who were in touch with residents also reported shelling in Homs. Homs is also home to one of Syria's two oil refineries. Eyewitnesses said people who fled through one of the neighborhoods being shelled said the area was terribly damaged and the shelling was indiscriminate. Syrian authorities are determined to crush the popular uprising. It began in the southern city of Daraa in mid-March and quickly spread nationwide throughout Syria. Bashar Assad has dispatched army troops backed by tanks to Homs and other cities around the country, and his own security troops have carried out sweeping arrests in an attempt to intimidate would-be protesters and to quell dissent. Of course, it was Bashar Assad's father, the late unlamented Hafez al-Assad, who ordered his own army to murder 20,000 residents of the rebellious town of Hama back in 1982. In Syria, like father, like son. In other news, playwright Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the book for West Side Story and the play Gypsy and the movie The Way We Were, died last week at the age of 93. Lawrence once described writers as the chosen people. Of course, he was a member of our people himself in both senses, chosen as a Jew and as a writer, I guess. His born name was Arthur Levine. In the making of West Side Story, based on an idea of the late great choreographer and director Jerome Robbins, Arthur Lawrence urged composer Leonard Bernstein to bring in a lyricist to help, and then he recommended Stephen Sondheim. Not a bad team. Lawrence's work included two plays about anti-Semitism, Home of the Brave, a story about a young Jewish soldier during World War II, and, of course, West Side Story, which was originally written about Jews and Italians or Irish in the Lower East Side. Both became hits after removing the Jewish elements. In his long, illustrious career, Arthur Lawrence survived being blacklisted for nearly a decade as a communist sympathizer. He was also known for directing the Broadway show La Cage aux Folles, and he eventually won three Tony Awards. And in Washington, D.C., the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case that will decide whether an American born in Israel can list Jerusalem on his passport, since the U.S. still refuses to recognize the capital of Israel as being part of the country. It's a long, ridiculous story, but suffice it to say that in spite of promises from every single U.S. presidential candidate of note for the past 30 years to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, America still doesn't and won't accept that simple fact. Leave it to the State Department. Let's see what the Supreme Court now has to say on that subject. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Cantor Bruce Rubin. He's the director of the School of Sacred Music at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in New York. He has taught Jewish history extensively at HUC, as well as at the Juilliard School and at Hunter College for many years. Cantor of Temple Shari Tefillah in New York City. He has worked in the field of not only Jewish music, but American Jewish history extensively. He's an accomplished historian of American Judaism and American Jewish music. We started to talk briefly about Nusach, the musical framework for Jewish prayer that goes back, well, some people say to the days of the Temple, but certainly deep into Jewish history. There's a big debate, or there has been at times in the Reform Movement, of whether Nusach was still applicable, whether it was important, whether it was an American Nusach. Can you help our readers understand Nusach, our listeners understand Nusach a little better today?
Nusach is a system that helps the worshiper identify what time of year it is. So there's a specific set of melodies that go along with the Sabbath. There's different melodies even for Friday night, and then for Saturday morning there are different Nusach traditions. Then there's a whole different set of traditions for the high holidays. And the knowledgeable Jew could be blindfolded and kept in a cave for months. If they walked into a synagogue without being told anything and they heard the Nusach, they could tell you what day of the week it was and whether it was a special holiday or something like that, just based on the melodies of the prayers they were hearing.
So today's Reform, and absolutely true. I mean, if you hear the, Yit Gadol, there's Kaddish in lots and lots of services, immediately it's Musaf on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But today's Reform Jews come from such a different, both more diverse musical background and much less knowledge of Jewish music. What is it that Nusach represents today?
I think it represents a connection back to our roots, to an authentic Jewish past. Many people don't even realize that they actually know some Nusach. People that come on the high holidays and hear the melody for, say, the Baruch Hu in the evening service will recognize it as authentically Jewish sound of Baruch Hu et Adonai Hamevorach. And that kind of Nusach or melody goes through that evening service, and even for pretty unknowledgeable Jews, there's a resonance. I think it helps invest that time with special meaning. We try to work on, we know that the world is different and that many people are not as knowledgeable about traditional melodies as they used to be, but we talk about ways of integrating the traditional Nusach traditions into a more folk tradition and using the Nusach in ways that can make it accessible to a modern congregant who may not be as knowledgeable.
So let's talk a little bit about the students of the School of Sacred Music and how that's changed over the years. When I was a chazan, it seemed to me that people coming up in the conservative movement tended to have a lot of knowledge of Jewish tradition and Nusach and Torah, but might not have had as strong a purely musical background. The students at HUC seemed to have strong musical backgrounds, either in classical and opera and musical theater, but maybe didn't have the same depth of Jewish knowledge. Is that still true today? What's your experience of it?
My experience is we get a real polarization. We get the people you described first. We get the people that come out of an opera or a musical theater background who need a lot of strengthening in their Judaica. But then we also get a good number of Jewish studies majors who enjoyed singing growing up, but don't have a very formal musical background, so we have to strengthen that side. So it's a challenge for the curriculum, because we have people coming in with different strengths and different deficits.
Do you think that there'll be a change in the professional status of cantors? Cantors are now often hired to be, you know, really full-service clergy. Is there going to be a push to move cantors back towards being cantor educators or part-time kinds of stuff?
Well, the model that we're pushing and encouraging is that of cantor as clergy partner. Now, in some cases, that's been true for many years in different congregations, but what we're trying to do is train cantors that not just sing beautifully, but also who can counsel people that are grieving, do the full set of life cycle functions, really carry the full load of what comes at you at a synagogue and be the partner of the rabbi in all of it as much as possible.
What is the best way, in your opinion, for a cantor to function in a synagogue? Obviously, it's a multi-level kind of task. Let's see if I can get at what I'm getting at. When I started the congregation, people would always, it was always good to replace people who weren't very good because you could change all the music at once. And then when you wanted to change stuff down the road, you were really competing against stuff that you had started. As a chazan, as a cantor, how much music can you change? What's the balance between familiarity and
That's a great question. And to some extent, you have to say each congregation is different. Each place has its own musical traditions. And in some places, part of that tradition is variety. I was at Shari Tefillah in Manhattan for 24 years, and I kind of trained my congregation to expect a number of different versions of the same prayer. And we did special music services that introduced the musical traditions of France and German Jewry and Italian Jewry and Sephardica. And so that over the years, my congregation understood that there is a vast range of Jewish musical styles, and there are many other people that do similar kinds of things. And yet at the same time, many people come to a service because there's a level of comfort that comes from the familiar. And they don't want to have to work so hard to get through services. If everything is new and jarring to them, then they're not going to want to come back because it doesn't fulfill that need. So there has to be a careful balance between doing the familiar things every week and introducing the new as well.
I want to thank Cantor Bruce Rubin for a great visit here on Two Jewish. If you want to find out more about the School of Sacred Music, you can go to the HUC website and find out what they're doing now and hear some of the beautiful music being created there. Thank you so much, Bruce.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out here on Two Jewish.
The Jewish outdoor holiday of Lag BaOmer is a wonderful, fun way to celebrate the early summer. Lag BaOmer combines a picnic, bonfire, lots of Israeli songs, and great activities for kids, teens, and adults on a beautiful in-town ranch. Saturday night, May 21st, starting at 5 p.m., join Temple Emmanuel for fabulous Lag BaOmer fun, including hayrides, ball games, horses, stargazing, contests, songs, and stories to celebrate the holiday. Everyone's welcome to the Temple Emmanuel Lag BaOmer picnic and bonfire on Saturday, May 21st at 5 p.m. Call 327-4501 for more information on Lag BaOmer with the Temple. It's just $7 for adults for dinner, dessert, and all the fun
and kids come and eat and play for just $3. Call Temple Emmanuel at 520-327-4501 to join us for Lag BaOmer fun.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Rabbi Jamie Korngold, the adventure rabbi, talking about her new book, The God Update. Our playout this morning is the very pretty Ki Elecha, sung by Sharona. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.